This podcast is brought to you by Wildflower Zen Sangha. This Dharma talk was given by Roshi Amy Hollowell.
Hello, everyone. This is we're in the middle of our second At Home Together retreat. I appreciate your presence. I'm very happy to see all of you. I'm grateful for your practice and the effort you make to step out of your daily life and sit down here with us and make this a priority for this time. I was thinking yesterday after the talk how it wasn't very practical what I discussed. In some respects it was, but I don't often give practical talks in the sense of, you know, talking about techniques and how to. I guess I function more in a do-it-yourself mode. And I thought maybe it was a beautiful story about the father and the son and opening the seed and seeing you are that. But, you know, in your everyday life and when you're sitting there on your cushion, how do you come to that insight? Sounds great when you're the one who shoots the arrow well, doesn't hit the target. But how does that happen? How do we get to that? How are we able to shoot the arrow well? So I just thought I would say a few things about that, and maybe we'll open it up, see if anyone wants to share anything. Joa may have some reflections from traditional Buddhist teachings on the subject, because I'm kind of I'm not an erudite scholar on traditional Buddhism. I'm not saying Joe is an erudite scholar, but he's much more interested in that and studies it much more in depth than I do. We hear so much about mindfulness today in our lives and in the popular culture, and it's almost lost all meaning. It's lost its Buddhist meaning in some respects, let's say. And yet it's not to be forgotten and not to be turned away from. It's one of the, on the Eightfold Path, it's one of the steps, and it's something in, you know, the Buddhist basic teachings, mindfulness is part of it. So it's something that we shouldn't overlook and, or belittle or say, oh, it's just become a commercial tool that's for sale. That's true. There, it has become that, but not only that. It's being used in all kinds of ways, in all kinds of domains, and interpreted in many different ways. But to come back to the basic Buddhist version, I think we can say that mindfulness, and I will explain this more, it helps us to be more at one with everyone. It helps us to experience what it makes each of us unique, and to see through the false separation that we usually establish. It helps us to see the open up the seeds and see that that is you, that is nothing, there's nothing there, but that is you, and the tree is there too. So, I like the way that Thich Nhat Hanh, he talks a lot about mindfulness from a very Buddhist perspective. And I haven't read and studied a lot about Thich Nhat Hanh, but I like a version of that he uses when he talks about mindfulness leading to concentration, which then leads to insight. And this is very practical and clear in a sense, because so if we are, and he gives this example of pouring tea. Some of you have maybe heard this or read this, that he uses a lot. Where he says, if you are mindfully, you know, or pouring a glass of water. So I have this glass of water and I pour it. So if I am mindfully pouring it, that means that I am entirely attentive to pouring the tea or the glass of water. I'm not thinking about where the tea came from, where the water came from, what it will be like to drink it, what the glass is, what the cup is, what my husband is doing in the kitchen, the car is passing by. I'm just fully attentive to pouring the glass of water. And when we do that, then the concentration arises. We are fully concentrated on pouring. And all of our energy is devoted to pouring that glass of water. And he describes himself doing this, and he said, and then I have the, when I look at the tea then, or the glass of water, I see a cloud. This is the insight that arises. I see a cloud. Yesterday, this water was a cloud. And then it rained. And it became a river or a puddle, or it eventually came to my glass. The water and the cloud are one. And all of these different causes and effects that brought it to this water that I'm drinking. And we can see the non-separation then. We can see the oneness of the water and the cloud and me. This is the insight that arises from the concentration, the combination of concentration and mindfulness. And I like this version that he uses because it's very practical and concrete. Now we can be mindful of our breathing. That's something we ask you to do when you're sitting. In the Zen tradition, we ask you to count your breath, but that's in order so that you will be mindful of your breathing. It's an added tool. Instead of just paying attention to your breathing, we say count it. So it's like, instead of saying innumerable things, we say 10,000 things. So we add something to help us be mindful of our breath. And then we develop concentration through that counting of the breath. In traditional teachings, we call that samadhi. We develop concentration, which is samadhi. And you may have heard that word. And this is, we notice this when we do meditation. You know, after sitting for 2 days, you notice that your concentration is more refined and more developed. You cultivate samadhi, we say. After a week of intense meditation, then you really have developed deep samadhi and concentration. And that's when insight can arise. That's when we have insights. That's when we have a glimpse of the cloud in the glass of water, or the sunlight in the flower. The flower would not exist without sunlight. Or the oneness between me and the person sitting next to me, on the cushion next to me. There is no distance between us. I share their feelings. You've heard me tell the story about a meditation retreat when the person across from me, it was for 2 weeks, and the person cried all the time. And I was really annoyed with that, that this person was crying all the time. And I had no idea why she was crying. I didn't care. I just wanted her to stop. And I became very irritated and angry, and I was mad at everyone in the retreat and hated everyone and didn't want to be with anyone except my teacher, and I hated her too. And really uncomfortable time. And it was all because this woman was crying. Well, as you can imagine, at some point towards the end of the 2 weeks, something happened and I started crying. And all of the distance and all of the hate and the irritation and the annoyance that I felt for that woman across from me vanished. I felt I was her and she was me. I knew her suffering, even though I don't know what she was crying about. I still don't. 25 years later, I have no idea what she was crying about. But it doesn't matter. She was hurting. I was hurting. Shared hurting. And through that, the separation dissipated and the pain was much different. The suffering was the air was taken out of the suffering as well. And funny to say, but I ended up, it was a really joyful retreat after that. The spontaneous joy arose and I was happy and I wanted to be with everyone again. There had been like the bottom had of the, whatever it was, had broken and the bottom of the bucket broke out. And this arose from the insight that came from concentration and mindfulness. And in this mindfulness, we develop a kind of a non-attached equanimity, as we were saying yesterday. So our mind is evenly balanced and aware of things as they are through this mindfulness and concentration. So, you know, we had, again, Debbie said something about, it doesn't matter. You know, I tell people they can come because it doesn't matter if you leave or if you stay. There's no pressure. And I said, that's true, it doesn't matter, but it does matter. But that's the equanimity that we develop. We can see both, we can hold both equally, leaving before the end of the period or arriving after the period starts, and being at the beginning and staying until the end. We can see both, we can hold both. And in that sense, they are equal. And in that sense, it doesn't matter, but they're different. And with the mindfulness and the concentration, it allows us to appreciate the difference between arriving after the start and leaving before the end, or arriving at the being at the beginning and staying until the end. One is not better than the other. That's the equanimity. But the mindfulness helps us to see the difference and appreciate the difference. Like I said, appreciate the uniqueness of each one of us. And then we can have an insight into the oneness, and also then what we are free to choose then. We are free to say, okay, I can't be there on time, it's okay. And I won't beat myself up because I can't be there on time. Or my priority is to be there on time. So I will be there on time. I'm just using that example because that's the example Debbie gave, you know, But we can apply this to any situation in our lives, any moment. And that's where this mindful, and so mindfulness is just really, unfortunately, in much of the popular usage of it, it stops before the insight aspect. At least from what I know, because I'm not, I don't really pay much attention to the popular uses of mindfulness, but the mindfulness in itself and the concentration are valuable. In the Buddhist tradition, we carry it on to the insight, because that's what we value in the sense of what we are, what our intention in our practice is to experience the oneness of life. So as I said earlier, to see through this false separation or this illusion of separation, because our basic delusion is separation. So, and an attachment to an idea of self. So if we look at that, that we cultivate this mindfulness as a practice so that we cultivate concentration, so that we can be open to insight, then it's something different than just mindfulness stopping there. There was something I noted yesterday and I forgot what it was. It doesn't matter. And that also brought me to, so I mentioned my Dharma name and all of your Dharma names, how they all are talking about the same thing. And I thought about the Rakusu. And how I had read recently about a judge in the United States who is also a Buddhist practitioner. And she was writing about how her Buddhist practice helps and affects her work as a judge, and how her work as a judge applies to her Buddhist practice. Now, it was very interesting. I can't remember all the details, but one of them was that she said when she puts on her robe, as a judge, she puts on a robe, a black robe, much like in traditional Zen practices, we put on a robe. And she said, you don't get to choose what robe it is. You don't get to choose if that robe will look good on you or if that color is flattering. But that helps you to not focus on yourself and your opinions and your ideas and your attachments. It helps you to focus more on non-self and helps her to cultivate non-self. And it helps her also, it reminds her of the humbling impact of her role, because she is judging, she's being asked to judge people, situations. And this is very humbling. And it's a weighty, it's very consequent. It weighs heavily, that task on her. But she said that if she can come to it, she said it's the same she cultivates the same mind of returning her attention to the inside, to non-self, as she would on her cushion, to experience the oneness and the non-duality, to hear all of the arguments with equanimity, and to be, to come with, she quotes Martin Luther King. This is an African-American woman. And so she's also her big inspirations are the Buddha and Martin Luther King. And she quotes Martin Luther King as saying something like, justice is the power to act with love or something like that. And with love, it's not act with love, but to put things on the right path of love or something. So she tries to come to her work with that, with equanimity, with non-separation. So she sees herself in the other, and with love. So she's, when she's making her decisions, she's acting with wisdom and compassion, we could say. And that she finds that when she speaks, you know, she has to speak with a certain type of language that is, let's say, that has equanimity, that embodies wisdom and compassion. And if she uses words that convey to the people she's speaking to that she understands their predicament, that she understands their feelings, that she knows what their suffering is. If she can convey that, she said very often that changes how her judgment is received. And we can understand that too, because we know if someone, you know, if someone says to you, yeah, I really, you know, if you feel someone has hurt you, and they acknowledge your hurt, it changes the way that you feel about it and the way that you feel about them. And it's not like she's making excuses, she said, but she's just conveying to them that she knows their situation, their suffering. And she realizes that she has half of the people in the room will be unhappy with her judgment. She knows that. And yet she said, sometimes if she can acknowledge that sometimes judgments are wrong, it's almost as if everyone will accept her judgment, even if they're not happy with it. That if she can acknowledge that sometimes, you know, there is injustice, they will accept that she will be delivering justice. And this, she said, comes from her ability to stay mindful, concentrated, and awaken to the oneness, something like that. The reason I tell that story is because of the robe. And I know at a time in my practice with my teacher, when we did wear robes and I wore a robe, I had that same sense of the robe helped you because you couldn't choose the robe. Some people did, you know, they wanted really special robes and they wanted silk robes and they wanted exactly this robe. And actually it was much better if you didn't have a choice. The robe I got was given to me. And then the second robe I had was given to me by the Sangha when I received transmission. So I didn't choose my robes. And that's actually very powerful because, like she said, you can't choose the robe that looks good, that has a special kind of fabric or a special color. It's black. That's your robe. And it helps to make everyone the same. It's like the story of Suzuki Roshi, who, when the students, the hippies in the 60s in San Francisco asked, you know, why do you want us all to shave our heads and wear black robes? And he said, because when you all have your beads and beards and long hair and flowing robes, flowery robes, I can't tell you apart. But when you're all wearing black robes and have shaved heads, I can see each of you as you truly are. That's an extreme position, but there is some truth to that. We come back to our original face. And I talk all of this because when we put on the rakusu, it's the same thing. The rakusu is a mini robe, if you will. And the Buddha's intention when he asked his disciples to take off their fine clothes. Most of them were from upper class cultures and had beautiful clothing. He asked them to take that off and wear whatever was given to them, to make robes out of pieces of fabric that were given to them. And they did, so that they were just like everyone else, nobody special. And with our rakusus, that's the intention too, to remind us of that. So can we put on our rakusus with that kind of mindfulness? You know, when we, like she puts, the judge puts on her robe in the morning, and she says she does a robe meditation, even if it's really brief. This is what we're supposed to do with our rakusus before we put it on. We put it on our head and we chant the verse of the Kesa. Even if it's just when we're sitting at home before we come on Zoom, we put it on and we chant it to ourselves. It helps us to come back to cultivating this view of non-self, of you know, there is a humbling impact of putting on the rakusu as well. These are bodhisattva vows you've taken. This is like a judge vows, a judge's vows, or a doctor's vows. These are bodhisattva vows. So you're taking these vows for the sake of helping others. And that's a heavy thing. That's weighty. That weighs on you. It can. And this is a reminder of that, of your role as a bodhisattva. It helps us to come back to remember the insight of the experience of oneness, of the cloud in the cup of water, of the reminds us to cultivate that, to be mindful. So when we wear this, we are more mindful. It's just natural because we don't want to spill something on it. We take it off when we go to the toilet. We're careful. We're more careful. We're more mindful. And that we develop concentration from that. And from that combination of mindfulness and concentration, we can have insights. And so this is another way of treating that. Making the rakusu is a big part of that as well. There's a mindfulness involved in that, and a concentration that develops, samadhi that develops, and an awareness of what it is. You're paying attention to what you're doing. It's a practice in itself. Joe is making his kesa. That's also a practice like that. I asked a friend of mine who is a Zen teacher, not in our lineage, in White Plum, but not in our lineage, who ordained as a monk many years ago, so has a monk's kesa, and also is a Zen teacher, received transmission, and so has a teacher's kesa, which is the Buddha's robe. And so I asked her, since Joa was, you know, making his, and I thought maybe she could help him, she knows him, whatever. And she said, oh no, I didn't make my quesas. I bought my quesa. I bought my quesa, my monk's quesa. And my other quesa, I think she bought both of them actually. And I thought, what a shame. You know, what a missed opportunity. Maybe she thinks that I'm missing an opportunity, you know, by having my students make their quesas. You know? There are a lot of Zen schools in which you buy your rakusu as well. In fact, there's a center in our Tenke, my teacher's Dharma brother, his center sells rakusus, right, Joa? And they sell quesas too? Yeah. So they make them and sell them for people who want to buy them. They don't do that. They don't buy them themselves. They each make their rakusus and quesas. But in order to generate income, they make them for other people who want to buy them. So a missed opportunity to cultivate mindfulness, concentration, and insight. But the opportunities, there are 10,000 of them every moment. So maybe by not making a rakusu, you could be cultivating mindfulness, concentration, and insight somewhere else with all that time you're spending making the rakusu. I don't know. So those are just a few things I wanted to say to complement yesterday's talk. The other thing was from Thich Nhat Hanh. He likes to make bridges between Christianity and Buddhism because he has a lot of Western students who were raised in Christian, Judeo-Christian culture. And so he talks about the Holy Spirit as being the quality of presence we have when we have developed mindfulness, concentration, and insight. And that the Holy Spirit is not only present in Christ, but it's present in you. You embody it when you cultivate those three aspects of practice. That was a good one too, actually, that could speak to us, because we always think of Holy Spirit as being, I don't even really know, because I know in Portugal, there's a big thing around the Holy Spirit, but I'm not really sure what it is. I know they talk about it a lot, and it's like, you know, in all the artwork and everything, but it seems different than what in French Catholicism we talk about it, or even in Protestant practices, which I was raised in. So in any case, I like Thich Nhat Hanh's version. It speaks to me. And I think he's right. The Holy Spirit is always there, but we reveal it and embody it when we cultivate mindfulness and concentration and insight. So I'll open it up there. And Joey, do you want to say anything about mindfulness or any of these things as they apply in the traditional teachings?
Yeah, one thing that I find very useful is that the word that we use for mindfulness is that Pali term called sati. That was Roshi's cat's name. And that has the sense of mindfulness, and that has the sense of memory, what we remember, the collectedness. So the question is, what do we remember? And that goes back to the insight, and also that goes back to the Eightfold Path itself. So the ethical, kind of the ethical framework of the whole Eightfold Path. So I think that's when Roshi was talking about putting the rakusu on, I feel when we recite the vow, we remember also our path, our dedication to cultivate something very specific, in fact, certain qualities. And I always find that beautiful, because when we recite the verse of the Kesa, we bring back to our mind that intention of cultivating this mind of awakening, this bodhicitta, and all the various aspects. And we've just finished this precept course, and that's also one of the manifestations of that path. And I also, about the various practices, I feel this, it's true that in Zen sometimes I feel the formulation very, very short, very condensed, very straight to the point. There are also ways to unpack it. And we have all kinds of texts in the sutras where they actually give very precise practices. But also we've studied that with the precepts, through the precepts, for example, the questions that we that were being asked, or when we studied that dana, the what it's called, Dominique, the 7 points of awakening. I mean, there are all kinds of practices where slogans, I find slogans very, very useful for that. And I find that can be applied in very specific situations. I use them very often. Slogans related to precepts, when I was thinking of precepts, or slogans that are very specific to what I'm doing. And I think that's another way to go back to this mindfulness aspect. That's what I would add.
Thank you. Yeah. Anyone else want to say anything? Questions or comments, or how it, you know, how you do it or don't do it, or so.
Hello, everyone. It reminds me, it's not the first time when I know this weekend it's a retreat from this day to this day. I'm always thinking I have to work a lot in the weekend, and I can't do this. I have not the time. It's not possible. But then I decide to try, and always it comes to me a better concentration in work and in Zendo. It's a fight that I have to make all the things, the 10,000 things, and it becomes better than I'm not here, when I decide to not be here, or only to work, or only to to be here. And it's the puzzle that functions very good by me.
Thank you, Sue. I think we can probably all relate to that in a way, you know?
Yeah.
And it's true that my cat was called Sati. That's true. And we named her that because of that. That's what the name meant. And she was a wonderful practice. It was really a joyous practice, Sati, with her.
Did you actually settle on the cat's new name?
The new cat's name?
Yeah, the new cat name.
We think so, but I think I will announce it when we actually have her. We're going to wait and see. We should have her on Thursday. And the second one we will not have until July. And he is a male. The first one is a female and the second one is a male. But we have seen them. We've seen pictures of the younger one. And I will plan to go see her next week, him next week. Just visit him. Debbie, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, first, if you have pictures, will you send them to us so we can see what we're up against, what you're up against?
Yeah. Well, because for those of you who don't know, the cat is a gift from the Sangha. For my birthday in December, they said they were giving me a cat, a kitten. But there were no kittens at that time. You have to get them in springtime. And so there were lots of great saga around this kitten, but finally we will get her. And we wanted two, but the others died. The other kittens in the litter died. So we could only have one. And we found another from another friend. We found another one from another litter. So we only have two. And it's thanks to the wildflowers.
Yeah, I feel like I'm plugging this activity, but we're talking about mindfulness, just everyday mindfulness. It came up during the confinement, I think. Doing things left-handed, and I'm right-handed, since I have to be careful if I'm doing dishes or anything with the other hand, all of a sudden, it's not quite zazen, but it zonks me into, I'm not just doing the dishes. I'm not just wiping off the table. And the other night I was working on a sewing thing, waiting to be sewing the bag for Joanne's papers. And I started sewing left-handed, unconsciously. And that's kind of weird. My left hand now is gonna come out and start doing things. But my mother was left-handed and she sewed. So maybe there's an back memory of imitation. But for me, the way to come into mindfulness the things that we do every day, turning the key in the lock with the left hand can take me 5 minutes. I go the wrong. My locks have been put on backwards, first of all, for some reason that I didn't quite follow. So already I have to remember that they're not in the right direction. Then I switch over for the left hand. And it really, I don't know if it's not done then. I'm not pushing it that far. But it does make me, it's not just an automatic gesture, is what I'm saying. So if you want to come do my dishes with your left hand.
Actually, kind of on that topic, what I do find useful is when I do something, I start to do two things at the same time. Multitasking, and I stop and I'm like, do I actually need to do this other task? What's preventing me from just doing one task and just doing fully one task? And I find that very useful. The question, for example, when I actually sewing my queso, or when I'm driving, doing another activity at the same time, listening to the radio or listening to some, and I'm thinking, paying attention to that. Why is that so unbearable to just do one thing? So.
Yeah, good question. Why is it that we want to do several things at the same time? And I do it all the time. I say, I'm going to go have a nap, and then I bring the newspaper and a book. Or my notebook and a newspaper or something. So why is it that we do that? And it's true, there's great power in just doing one thing and like doing it with your left hand because Debbie's forced to do it. that helps you be more focused, more mindful of it. And like when like Joe says, you put on the music when you're driving, we do that when we're counting our breath. We quickly discover that we can really skillfully count our breath from 1 to 10 and start over again, all the while thinking about this thing we have to do at work and thinking about what my mother said to me 20 years ago that still annoys me or something. You know, I mean, it's like these various levels of our mind is so skillful that we do it all the time. So it's powerful to turn it off, you know, turn off the radio or use the left hand so that it brings us back to just this. Like I said yesterday, do one thing repeatedly. Great power. Joao?
Because you just mentioned that we skillfully start being able to count the breath, count until 10, while I started noticing that a couple of months ago. And so I remembered something I had read many years ago. And so I tried to make it really difficult so to prevent that, because there are all these examples, these proposals, you can count like odd numbers or even numbers, and then even counting backwards, and that sometimes that can become easier. So it's like skipping 3 backwards, for instance, that's kind of difficult. And so yeah, because I started noticing that, yeah. It's really important to it comes to me very often when I'm sitting. At the same time, trying to be aware that it's just a tool. It's just, that's not like the purpose in itself. It's not. It comes to me very often that it's just a tool. Yeah.
It's a tool that we use to cultivate mindfulness and concentration, and then therefore insight. That's right. Absolutely. And so like by count, you know, making it more complicated, it's the equivalent of using your left hand when you're right-handed, you know, it's like, you know. And so the thing is, why do we, you know, I ask the question of why do we distract ourselves? Why do we do several things at the same time? Why does our mind go off skillfully doing this other stuff? Why do we have to make it more difficult? It's basically just because we're incapable. We're not incapable. We don't want to be just with what is here and now. We want something else. We're so conditioned to something else, something else, something else, that we need to break that conditioning to just appreciate what is here right now. You know, it's like we look at the screen and we say, okay, there's how many people? There's 16 people. And then I can go back and look at the list and say, oh, well, there's 27 who signed up. Those people are not here, you know, but if we just are with what is, we just appreciate who is here. This is what it is. Or instead of like thinking about, now, why isn't this person there? This person wrote to me and said, they're not going to be here today because of this. Oh, I know this person because of this. What, it doesn't matter. Then I'm not here with you. No. And when we're counting our breath, if we're thinking about a million other things, we're not really just here with this, which is the absolute perfect, place to be and the perfect thing to have is just this. Oh, but it's so hard to do that, you know.
Yeah, I think for me, sorry, Miguel. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, the appreciation is I feel it's a really important piece of the puzzle. I think very often I do two things at the same time because I don't want to wait because I feel life time is so precious, so I need to make it very productive. So I've spent a lot of time in the country these days, and I sometimes I do what I call my Dharma walks. So I go for a hike, listening to a Dharma podcast. But while doing that, I'm totally not paying attention to where I'm going, not appreciating that the actual walk. And sometimes I get lost because I haven't paid attention to where I'm actually going in the forest. And then I realized this is becoming really silly, this thing. But I don't want to waste a drop. So I'm doing the walk because it's really important to go for a walk from time to time and not spending all my time in front of my computer. And I really want to listen to and learn more stuff. And then, so it's becoming this ongoing race in order not to waste a drop. But while doing that, I'm missing the opportunity also to actually really enjoy the walk and enjoy the forest and paying attention to the environment in the forest. So, and same thing with the driving, which seems, well, you know, it's really just not really interesting going from one place to the next in the car for an hour. So let's listen to the podcast or show or something, whatever. And then it becomes again this race, whereas just even driving on a highway and being stuck in, that's also can be a meditation.
Yeah. Miguel, you wanted to say something?
Yes. Well, at the same time, and it doesn't contradict what you were saying about this multitask thing. In the teachings on Sati, in the Satipatthana Sutta, we are invited to pay attention to these four aspects of life, so to speak. And in the body, in sensations, in the mind, and in the phenomena. So we are invited to pay attention to the breathing and to the positions in the body, the activities in the body, that the body is constituted by these elements, that we are. The body is constituted by this anatomy and the sensations flowing. There's the process of thinking flowing. And so at the same time, we develop sati, mindfulness, in all these aspects. Of course, it's in some sense, it's one by one. And at the same time, well, it's not. They are all, and that would bring us, in some sense, to what you said before, to kind of concentration, in the sense of a unification of the mind. Not just in the sense of I'm concentrated in the breathing, but there's a unification of the experience, a connection to whatever is happening. Then I think it relates more to the Zen practice, being open to whatever is happening. So and this will bring, it opens to the insight, as you said.
What were those four that you said? The four.
The first one is the body, mm-hmm. And then in the body there's the positions in the body, if you are laid down or you are seated, or and then there is the activities, whatever you are doing. And there's monasteries that really put attention in that. You are hitting, so you are hitting. Pay attention to that. And just then they develop concentration, and and then there's the breathing. And then there's the scanning of the body, paying attention to the anatomy. You have bones, you have flesh, you have skin here. And then there's another scanning of the elements. And this have a kind of, is to bring a kind of insight, these scannings. You are constituted by elements, and these elements inside are not different from the elements outside, and you are dependent on that. So we are interrelated. And then there's a scanning of the body as a scanning of death. You are dying at each moment, and invited to contemplate or imagine death. And there's the second is sensations. You do the scanning, noticing pleasurable sensation and pleasurable sensations and neutral sensations. And this will give rise to a kind of equanimity. And then the third is mind, the thoughts. And if you are with distracted or concentrated or whatever, and then this the dharmas, the phenomena, in the dharmas in the sense of phenomena, and you investigate the five hindrances. If you are with desire, or if you are with anger, or if you are agitated and preoccupied and with doubt. And then the five aggregates and seven factors of awakening, you know, all these kinds of, it's a kind of platform to bring you to a state of stability, you know, of really mindful and prepared to a samadhi and to the insight.
Yeah, so we see that there's so many different iterations of it and possibilities of how to apply it and work with it. I mean, that's a really elaborate one. That's the traditional one, though, and that's a very traditional one. And all to bring us to the same place, you know. It's fascinating. So when we, you know, I don't know if you like me kind of see, oh, you know, there's a mindfulness training, or, you know, this is some article in a women's magazine about mindfulness, I kind of turn the page. You know, there is the Tathagata's true meaning in it, in mindfulness, you know, so I think it's not to be discounted, but to be looked into and used appropriately, I think. Time is up. Oh, Catherine, yeah, go ahead.
I didn't keep track of time. I was just gonna say that my insight in listening today is that oneness isn't static. So we're constantly trying to be with the present moment, but all these different things are happening, and we can't just think about now without, I mean, they're the past and the future. So it's kind of inevitable that we're constantly flipping back from different scenes or different dimensions. That was just one thing I could go on, but we're out of time. So.
Well, no, please, if you want to say something else, go ahead.
One other thought I had, basically on what you were saying about being practical, is that I find that that's also an area where intention and technique overlap, because I think all of us here have intentions, very good at strong intentions of following some path of meaningfulness in our lives. And then every day we have, you know, our little confrontations, whether it's at work or at home or wherever you're socializing, because it's mostly, at least in my mind, with people, where you have to figure out how the other person is seeing something and how you're seeing it and how you can converge. And it's almost a negotiation technique with compassion. And it's, how do you do it? It's very tangible. You have, you know, so that's where I think technique is really useful, because you can't just have your intention. You have to actually get technical about it. Well, what is that person's interest? Why are they thinking this way? How can you, you know, what are your thinkings? What are your unconscious biases? And so on and so forth until you get to some sort of agreement. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you. And that's the, like all of these techniques that we've been outlining and talking about, we practice them, you know, we train so that we can develop our skill with them, so that when we are in a concrete situation with a colleague or a partner or, you know, the lady at the supermarket, that we can act appropriately because we are skilled. We've integrated the techniques and made them so much who we are that we've had these insights into it, and so that we can more easily interact and be free, fully functioning in the world. Because, you know, it's like I tell the story of learning to play tennis. When I actually go out on the tennis court, I'm not thinking about how I learned to hold the racket and how to do the backhand and how to throw the ball. And I just go out there and do it, you know? Because if I'm thinking about all the various aspects about how to do it, then I can't play. Or driving a car is another one. You know?
I also wanted to thank you. You talked about being there and not being there. And I just wanted to thank you and the Sangha for your flexibility, because it's a form of generosity in my mind to welcome people who aren't necessarily as committed, as faithful, as whatever, as present, and to still say, come, get, you know, take what you can from it, give what you can to it. For me, that's a form of generosity and welcoming.
Thank you. You know, I mean, and your presence is a form of generosity as well. And the basic, for me, the basic point is that it's not about how much or how often, but it's doing it entirely when you do, you know. So when you're here, you're here. And that's what's important. And we're here for that reason. So I'm happy that you're here. And I thank you for your comments, and all of you, that applies to all of you as well. Thank you for your presence and for coming and supporting us. So time is up, however. It's lunchtime, at least here in my house. I will see you later, I hope. Remember that I think there are still some spots for interviews if you want to sign up. You can check. I don't know how many there is, but this afternoon and tomorrow morning. Okay, thank you all.
If you have enjoyed this Dharma talk, just give us a visit on wildflowerzen.org.